Welcome to the third lecture on Landian philosophy of Bitcoin, 3.0 to 4.0. These two chapters are titled by Land as Bitcoin and its doubles and state of play. The first chapter is dealing with sort of some of the historical, economic and technical problems which we find in relation to currency. And the fourth chapter is in relation to game theory and games and cooperation. So when Land begins this chapter, he begins by... One thing I should emphasize that I didn't emphasize in the beginning of the whole series is that this isn't finished. Cryptocurrent by Nick Land isn't finished. So it's almost a bit crude of me to sort of be doing these lectures, but it's been so long and I know a lot of people wanted it to be tackled. So there you go. So this, the third chapter is where he really sort of knuckles down into the definitions and the language of what, you know, the language that's being used in the Bitcoin paper and how we can come to view that as a philosophical paper in itself. So, I mean, I'm going to read this out because some of the sections will, some of the terminology and some of the ideas will come back later on. So he starts, Land starts chapter three with this abstract to the 2008 Bitcoin paper by Satoshi Nakamoto. So a purely peer-to-peer version of electronic cash would allow online payments to be sent directly from one party to another without going through a financial institution. That's the removal of the third party trust, which the transcendent, the removal of the trusted third party that we've gone on about before. Digital signatures provide part of the solution, but the main benefits are lost if a trusted third party is still required to prevent double spending. We propose a solution to the double spending problem using a peer-to-peer network. The network timestamps transactions by hashing them into an ongoing chain of hash-based proof-of-work, forming a record that cannot be changed without redoing the proof-of-work. The longest chain not only serves as proof of the sequence of events witnessed, that idea of succession that we've gone on about before, but proof that it came from the largest pool of CPU power. As long as a majority of CPU power is controlled by nodes that are not cooperating to attack the network, they'll generate the longest chain and outpace attackers. The network itself requires minimal structure. Messages are broadcast on a best effort basis, and nodes can leave and rejoin the network at will, accepting the longest proof of work chain as proof of what happened while they were gone. There's so much going on there, but I mean, anyone who's been paying attention to these lectures will notice that everything Land is going on about and expanding upon is contained in this abstract, from succession, cryptography, the removal of the transcendent sort of hierarchical, authoritative father figure in philosophical terms, which is needed or supposedly needed in this flattening into a horizontal, imminent network of production in itself, which can be loosely understood here as the peer-to-peer version, production to production. So Land begins here with 3.01, and we will come back to this abstract and draw from it, because this is what chapter 3 is all about. I will probably move a bit faster in this lecture, because I noticed last time we're almost going on for, I think, 2 hours, and I didn't, you know, that's not as long as I really want to go on these, it's almost too long. But 3.01, conceived as a project of political economy, this is what Bitcoin is. Okay, so this is straight after he's mentioned the abstract. Now, in the terms of thinking about political economy, we're thinking about social contracts, and we're thinking about the idea of the social contract, going all the way back to, say, Hobbes, Locke, etc. You're thinking about the need for a third-party trust-based system to allow for some position of transcendent authority to come from somewhere which doesn't need some legitimized external function to legitimize its authority. So in terms of an external third-party transcendent other, etc., a god, a king, a boss, it's, you know, an institution, a corporation, a bank, a central bank, etc., their vindication for their authority is based on almost a self-vindicative loop, right? Divine right is based on its own hereditary principles, whether or not you're for or against that. In the same sense that power sort of compounds itself over time, whereas the vindication of power compounds itself over time. Whereas when we're talking about Bitcoin and we're talking about proof of work, we're talking about that CPU power and the legitimization of someone's sort of skin in the game with respect to Bitcoin is the amount of energy they've expended on the system itself. Therefore, they both expend and get back what they've expended from it, imminent to the network itself. So this has huge connotations with regards to political economy, in the sense that this actually connects to economics, and it also loosely connects to the social contract, which I mentioned earlier. But in an economic sense, which we'll get to later, it removes this idea of credit based on sort of status games. That's a super complicated thing to get into right at the minute, right, based off that conceived as a project of political economy. But what Bitcoin does to politics is really interesting, sort of taking its trajectory from that removal of the transcendent third party institution, because politics in itself is basically based around, at the moment and forevermore, even though we're apparently in a democratic society, is based around a pseudo understanding that there is a third party institution which we can rely on for our basics and our necessities. And in a sense, one could easily argue that in the immanentization of Bitcoin into the political economy, in its sort of agent in the machine or agent on the inside, it will erode that into some sort of imminent libertarian principle where the legitimization of what we would then consider power or political power is justified via one's, in abstract, skin in the game with regard to the system which they're trying to propagate. So if you're trying to propagate Bitcoin, how much is your skin in the game in terms of energy expenditure and your reliance on that same system, right? You can't just stay external to it, reap the rewards, but not actually be sort of beholden to that system. So there's actually a strange, even for land, there's a strange form of fairness going on here in a very sort of non-type way. And moving on to 3.05, land states the immediate substance of the monetary sign, inked paper, so notes, banknotes, etc., is approximately worthless. The paper of cash money does not reference a commodity substance, but a promissory vehicle, a vehicle which is promising something. Now, in the history of sort of economic, well, not sort of economics, in the history of economics, the origination of banknotes was that there was a realization that gold was becoming a store of value. There was an understanding that, you know, once you had a ton of value, you could easily quantify that via a block of gold, but gold is very cumbersome to move around all the time. So what a bank would do is then give you a note to say this person has this amount of gold and they wish to give it over to this other person. So it's basically a promise to say that you would that you would pay that. However, the realization from that was there was no longer any need to pay, because once that other person had that promissory note to pay, they might as well have had, in abstract and in loose terms, that same thing of gold, right? There was no need to actually move anything about, because that promissory note became a complete one-to-one representation to that commodity. Whereas there is definitely arguments to be had here in terms of the gold standard and it being backed against a finite substance or a finite material such as gold, which has a limited amount and has stayed relatively stable. It wouldn't have been a great investment over the years against Bitcoin and especially against lumber. The limitations of that and almost the finitude of gold is what allows it to have worth, whereas the worthlessness of paper is that it's a promissory note which is vindicating itself by just promising that it's a promissory note. If you can sort of understand what I mean there, the value judgment of a £20 note is because it's a £20 note, and it's not actually tied, even though it's tied to a very loose free floating abstraction of loose governmental power and a collective herd-like understanding of reverence for an authoritative figure, right? We trust in our institutions, we trust in God, we trust, etc. So the idea is there is the emphasis on trust
as opposed to work, right? So when you have this £20 note or these coins, etc., their value is simply based on an abstract collective agreement that they are that value, even though they are not tied to anything of a finite value. And the difference here with Bitcoin is that Bitcoin has developed itself. You know, we go back to that sort of almost nonsensical statement of BTC is BTC or Bitcoin is Bitcoin, in that ontological sense of value, which is proving itself. This is where we'll come to understand where the value is coming from in terms of almost skin in the game. And perhaps you could say sunk cost, but almost like positive sunk cost. We own BTC. We have the value. We actually have the actual value, whereas the representational material, which is a banknote, is a representation of something which is then attached to a sort of a free-floating signifier of a trusted third party and a collective simulacrum of value, right? It's like a completely false token of what it is to even be value, whereas Bitcoin has assigned itself in an ontological fashion via proof of work that it is value via the energy expenditure that people are giving into it. It becomes the actual value. So unlike a bank where you don't actually have that money, sorry to burst the bubble, but the amount of savings that you have in a bank, that you can't just go to some vault and open it up and there is some a relative amount of worth and value in relation to the digits you have on a screen. You literally have that those digits on the screen, but you don't even have them. You have whatever they represent in terms of this free-floating, fluxing network of authoritative, you know, the Royal Mint, the central banks, the government, in God we trust, this fluxing idea and simulacrum atop the actual layer of value, which there isn't actually such a thing in terms of monetary notes. That's just a representation of that fluxing nothingness of a £20 note. So don't look at your notes too long because you will have a breakdown. Which leads us into 3.1. Bitcoin is an experiment in Austrianism. In the words of Pierre Rochard, as Bitcoin adoption increases, we will finally be able to empirically validate what Austrians have been arguing for decades. 100% reserve banking with a scarce medium of exchange prevents speculative manias, financial crises, and economic depressions. Okay, what is fractional reserve banking and what is, as Rochard is saying here, 100% reserve banking? So fractional reserve banking means that the bank lends out money that clients have deposited with it. People deposit money, the bank then lend that out, and that is how the bank then makes money, right? Why else would they bother to do all this? They're not just doing it out of the kindness of their hearts. You deposit £10,000 into the bank, they can then invest that in something else and lend it out and recur interest and invest and develop themselves, etc. Fractional reserve banking, however, leads to a situation, not 100% reserve banking, fractional reserve banking leads to a situation in which two individuals are made owners of the same thing. So it's an immediate problem of the double spend problem. So for instance, if one of you guys or myself deposits £10,000 to a bank and I can still withdraw that money, then two people are actually using the same amount of money, thus developing a complete void of value. Because if I can still withdraw the money, then I can use that whole 10 grand to go do something. But let's say I deposit it, the next day the bank uses it, but of course they know that I still would like to use it. So they are using that money on this completely empty form of credit. Okay, and then we can both use it. So there's actually a complete double spend problem there in relation to the economy, in the sense that two people are using technically that same amount of £10,000. And from that, you can see how utterly bloody useless £10,000 is, because it just becomes this free floating signification of what value and where value is meant to be. So people such as Hans Hermann Hoppe, Bloch, Hulsmann, they note that any contractual agreement that involves presenting two different individuals as simultaneous owners of the same thing, as I just gave the example, or alternatively, the same thing, that same £10,000 is simultaneously owned by more than one person, this is literally fraud. This is objectively what fraud is. It's false. That is complete untruth. It can't be. If you're going to have value, it cannot be in that sense. It has to have an objective standing in the sense that there is value. And in this, we get closer to why Bitcoin is so important for the economy and for philosophy.
So a fractional reserve banking agreement implies that no lesser an impossibility and fraud than that involved in the trade of, you know, of anything just ridiculous, right? It just can't be. This two people owning the same thing can't be in the same way a circle can't be a square, right? So 100% reserve banking is a ratio of 100%, which means that even if every single customer in the bank demanded to take out their money, the bank will definitely have it all available, right? That's how it should be. Whereas they probably wouldn't if people did that because the bank are constantly using the money. So that's a safe form of banking. But as described so far, the problem, of course, would be how the hell would banks even work? Because then they would just work as a deposit box, right? You go, here's the money. Obviously, you can't use it because I still want to use it. So how would this work? So a 100% or full reserve system is very natural. It works just as you'd expect. You'd expect money to work if there were no banks and no checks, right? So before banks, before checks, before credit, if I lend someone $500 for 3 months, they have that $500 and I wouldn't expect to be able to spend that $500 while that other person has it, which is what banks expect, right? So that is what would happen with banks. Is what you'd be able to do is basically go, I'll deposit my $500 and I'll lock it for a certain amount of time and I can't use it. And that's when the banks can invest. And then when I go back, they've done whatever they wanted to do with it. And I can then use it. But neither of us are using twice at the same time. Now, this seems very practical in terms of the economy. But what we're actually talking about is an objective form of value, because you can't have objective value if that objective, almost ontological piece of value, if you like, is used at the same time, right? Two people can't use it at the same time. That you can't have value or truth in that matter. In that sense, Bitcoin is a production of truth because it's not digressing into false states of duplication. And it completely avoids the double spend problem by that successive peer-to-peer decentralized agreement on what has happened in the system. So it's a continual decentralized peer-to-peer agreement on who has the money, therefore someone else can't spend it, in that successive form of time. And in being a form of value, it develops that form of time as an ontological objective truth of what has happened as agreed upon, decentralized, without that higher trust, which I will keep going on about. I could, of course, bring in the fact, you know, we're talking about Austrianism and there's something. I mean, I've been talking about Karl Menger, which is a series I still need to finish. I literally have it already, but I don't know why I haven't. I mean, in terms of very key, clear economic thinkers, right, you have Keynes, who's ruined everything ever. You have Marx and you have Mises. And very loosely, you can say the Marxist, very, very loosely, the Marxist understanding of value is from labor and labor time, how much of one's labor has gone into it. And then from that, we can develop the worth in this sort of humanistic push towards not the material itself, but the notion of the worker in their emancipation and our relationships and fetishistic relationships to objects. Then you have Keynes, who is saying, no, there is a price. Value is related to price. Someone puts a price on something, and that is the value of it, apparently agreed upon. And then Keynes, in relation to the financial sort of the breakdown in the 20s, was basically because he said, well, the government should just lob a load of money into everything, which actually ended up with the private institutions not wanting to put money back into the economy because you had this centralized form of governance, which they didn't know, you know, where's this money coming from? You're just building the same bubble again. And we're seeing these same bubbles over and over again with this injection of false money into things, which people like James Kunstler go on about with credit swaps and things like this. So, what happens when we get to Mises? One interesting thing, which I, you know, is somewhat related to Bitcoin, is Mises and the Austrians in general adhere to one fairly strict principle emanating from Karl Menger, who took it out rigorously in his first book, but also from the law by Frederic Bastiat, right, which is value is subjective. You can put a price on something. You can put a price and say, James, this pen is worth £10,000. And I'll go, not to me, because it isn't, right? And that's subjective value, which is things are worth what they are worth to that person,
That's all value is. You can't just put a price on something and that means it's worth that thing. And I mean, Bitcoin is working on this same level, but I thought I'd throw in there the Austrian terms for, and you also have marginal utility in the sense of, you know, £1 million would be extremely useful to me. 10 million would be fantastic. And as it goes up and up and up, what is really the point of it? And eventually it becomes sort of a burden in the same way. Let's say, for instance, I eat a lot of steak, which I do. Let's say, for instance, someone comes over and they gives me one. I'll be like, oh, that's great. Thanks very much. Someone comes over and gives me five. That'll do me for the week. Someone comes over and gives me 10. Oh, I could eat a lot more. Someone comes over and gives me 20. I could probably just about manage to eat that before it goes out of date. Someone comes over and gives me 100. I've then got to start finding ways to deal with this. So the point of that is there is a point where you go, right, the marginal utility cost is stupid at this point. I don't need any more. And there'd actually be a negative, a net negative on my on my life at this point. So moving forward, because I said I wouldn't go on too long, and I'm literally on the first slide and we're like 20 minutes in. So 3.14. The DSP originates from a fact so basic that it crosses from the order of empirical actuality into that of transcendental principle. Signs are cheap. To substitute a sign for a thing, a signification for a demonstration, is an economization. I mean, this relates sort of back to Deleuzean thought with the idea of the actual and the virtual. But how can we then determine value within a framework entirely of signs of value, which is what we're talking about when we're talking about notes and coins and credit? You know, credit, what is it? A promissory note or a credit is literally a sign to signify there should be value there. And once, you know, for instance, when we go back to that idea of promissory notes, how can you determine value within a framework entirely of promissory notes if you removed the actual empirical validator of that signification? You know, the entire value structure is, let's say, tied to gold as an empirical value. Once, and you have all these promissory notes related to that. Once you remove that, what do you then have to do? It's no longer in gold we trust, which is an empirical finitude. It's in God we trust, which, you know, you might believe, you might not. However, it's not empirically able to be validated on the same level of communication as we're talking about with the economy. So you come unstuck because everyone just has to freeze up and go, okay, we'll just agree that these signs are the value themselves, which eventually can lead to these double spend problems because the bank is just working with a sign and not an empirical thing, which they can go, no, we can't actually spend that again because we haven't got it, which you can't do. You literally cannot do with Bitcoin. You have Bitcoin. You have that value. If it moves, it moves. There is no literally no objective possibility for that type of double spend fraudulence. So, I mean, one note I would put in here in relation to transcendental philosophy, right, a note on symbolism in relation to the transcendental critique is that symbols are a means of communication to the outside. They are means of the outside communicating itself to the inside in the sense of a compressed form of data. When we think of a symbol or a glyph, you look at a symbol and you have a cognitive ability to unfold that compressed form of data, which there is a greater production of on the outside. And this symbol on the inside sort of expands and unfolds out into something far greater. And you have a sort of a communication. And this actually happens with markets, with money, with a monetary economy, in the sense that we can look at markets and they're no longer just these digital significations of what we would consider metric numerals on the empirical inside, but via that data we can unfold that out into a greater greater longevity of a scheme of things, in the sense that they become a form of understanding what is happening with production on the outside, right? When we look at profit and loss rates in relation to the concept of zero, we can understand where we're going wrong and what is happening on the outside in that level of work and production. So in substituting the sign for a thing, right, as Land states, Bitcoin overcomes that Humean skeptical empiricism of like, well, anything could just be happening, because the actual value it represents, the sign is subsumed into what it signifies. There is no longer the sign and the signification. These are assimilated into pure value, pure transcendental value, an immanence, if you like, of value and production into a single thing. There is not, on an ontological level, there is not a sign for Bitcoin. It is the same thing. You cannot have the sign and the value. Bitcoin is Bitcoin. And I hope that sort of almost nonsensical statement is starting to make sense. So, 3.15, simply by protecting itself against splits or forks, the blockchain constitutes the consistent plane of being upon which any particular being can be what it is and nothing else. Instead, once again, you are that. You can't be anything else fraudulently because it has to be cohered in a decentralized framework with everyone else on that network. Positive absence of duplicity is thus an efficient ontological criterion or selective principle, right? We know where we stand. Ontologically speaking, there is no possibility of duplicity because the value has to remain on that objective, fully decentralized, agreed upon framework. So the value is where the value is. There is no, you can use this for a bit. The blockchain is predetermined to construct reality in such a way that fraudulence will not have taken place, back to that idea of 100% reserve banking. And that alone remains real, which is consistent with the integrity of identity money or potential value. So this goes back to, once again, you know, goes back to the idea of 100% reserve banking. Empirically, the possibility of a fraudulent split is nil. There is no possibility of that. And there is no duplication of money, therefore no duplication of value. And the sign as assimilated stays in with it. It's only in that split, that possibility of a split, that you end up having this potential for a network of promissory signs, which then divides the value and the sign. And then you get lost into what we're in at the moment, which is just basically an entire system of credit and promises, right? There's no digressions. What is built is built. What is produced is produced. And what is produced is what is produced. There is no like credit of production, right? So Land then goes into 3.2. So the Bitcoin paper consists of 12 short sections, including an introduction and conclusion. It's compressed to a minimal summary at this point, although discussed in pieces throughout the book and rehearsed at slightly greater length in the first appendix. The emphasis here is critical oriented and, as is the paper itself, to the dissolution of the DSP and thus the construction of a plane of transactional immanence from which all transcendent elements or trusted third parties have been evacuated. The transcendental argument of the Bitcoin paper runs as follows. And from this, there is, I believe, might be, yeah, 12 little things where Land begins to sort of summarize what's going on transcendentally with the Bitcoin paper. So, 3.21. The trust-based model is expensive, socially frictional, and vulnerable to fraud. The trust-based model, because you have to rely on trust. You go, right, I've definitely got the thing. Well, how do you know you've got the thing? You know, if you put it into a centralized bank, as we can see from that idea of banking which goes out beyond, you may very well not actually have the value. And once you begin to lose the value, what is once value begins to be lost, it's pointless because it's not value. To overcome these problems, Bitcoin proposes the substitution of cryptographic proof for trust, right, which is to be obsolesced by irreversible crypto commitments. The elimination of trust-based mediations reduces transaction costs. The system remains resilient in the absence of oversight, so long as a predominance of applied CPU power is controlled by honest nodes. The removal of trust basically also removes the human element. Trust is a non-algorithmic human idea, right? There isn't a production of trust and a verifiably ontological way of looking at trust in the sense of that. Trust is a human trait. It is not a machinic trait. Machinic, you could say that machines replace trust for production because in that Deleuzian sort of, I don't want to say post-Kantian, I'll just say Deleuzian sense of production in itself of the outside, what matters is the production in itself. And they could say, well, there's no such thing as trust because they wouldn't. It's almost like the equivalent of that human thing that programmers like to say, you know, shut up and show us the code, right? What's been produced? I mean, not even on an empirical level, but what's been produced in the terms of that continuation of the system into what is going to continually propagate the system. So you don't go, oh, well, just trust me on this. No. We don't trust. There is either production, there is not production. There is not a mediation of trust in between, which is what is happening on the human level. So instantly, from the removal of trust generally and from the removal of a third party form of trust, you're actually abstractly removing the human element. You're dragging us back and saying, you are now sort of below the system. You've been demoted, even in an imminent way. You've been demoted, sort of pseudo-demoted within your own minds. Well done. You know, you've developed a further behemoth of capitalist Leviathan. So, 3.22. An electric coin is defined as a chain of digital signatures, which is equivalent to a chain of ownership. This is described later in the conclusion of the usual framework for cryptocurrency construction. The elimination of the need for a trusted third party or mint requires that transactions be publicly announced within a system that enables participants to agree on a single history of the order in which they received. Very simple. Everything is in a chain of ontologically verifiable and economically verifiable succession, which is then cross-referenced with everyone in the decentralized flat system in a peer-to-peer way. Everyone goes, yes, that is when that is spent, therefore that person can't have it, therefore that can only be used by that person. The value doesn't digress, the value doesn't split, the value doesn't fork, therefore the value always stays where the value was agreed upon by everyone in the system, thus developing an objectively verifiable form of succession, which is what we're talking about as the absolute time. It's an economically absolute time. And we'll just move on to this actually in 3.23. This is sort of emphasized that Bitcoin's synthetic history draws upon established procedures for digital time validation using a timestamp server to chain its hashed blocks in succession. Each timestamp includes the previous timestamp in its hash, constructing an artificial history as a robust series of envelopments or ordered swallowings, with each additional timestamp reinforcing the ones before it. This absolute form of linear time vindicates itself in the sense that it's just constantly propagating an objectivity, which is agreed upon, once again, decentralized by the decentralized flat horizontal network, in developing an absolute succession, which then Land goes on to say solves the problem of Kantian spacetime. There is no real simpler way to put it than has been put so far in the lectures. I'm sorry if I can't really see myself on the camera. I'm sorry if I'm covered in sweat. It's extremely hot here. And I had to close the window because there's just loads of people screaming outside, probably because there's someone, you know, in a house nearby ranting about Bitcoin. So 3.24, the timestamped blocks are secured against tampering by proof-of-work locked hashes. Such irreversibility is at once a deployment of cryptographic asymmetry, a consumption, a consummation or of contractual integrity, and a realization of time-like successive order. Notably, it is isomorphic with a thermodynamic or statistical mechanical gradient. Very complex idea there, but what we're talking about is the production in itself on the outside is being transformed in that sense of, you could, if you had to think about it in a human way, you could think about it in symbolization. You could say that even though there is a symbolization of succession in the blockchain, what is then happening is a complete coherence between that ontologically production in itself of the outside into this, you know, as Land states very tongue-in-cheek there, time-like successive order on the inside. And it builds a coherence as to whether, you know, that whole idea of, you know, Kant constantly sort of make it clear, we don't know, you know, we don't know either way whether or not that is the real, and we don't know whether or not this is the real, but what it is a coherence between what we do know and what we don't know. And what we do know is what we apparently could maybe not know, but even so, it secures that in being what it is and then coheres it against something else from the outside. So, 3.25, the network reproduces itself through a six-step block creation cycle, since nodes always consider the longest chain to be the correct one. Synthetic history as an ordinal quantitative variable functions as a selective ontological criterion. Accepted blocks provide the building materials for the subsequent cycle of network production. Accepted blocks is basically... you know, everyone's just once again agreed upon it. This is sort of a repeat, but I'm just emphasizing what Land has put in here as a sort of emphasis of what's important. But this idea of acceptance is from the cryptographic proof and not from trust. So acceptance is skin in the game. It's in a sort of positive sunk cost of production in terms of your sort of allegiance, if you like, to that imminent system of Bitcoin. So 3.26, Bitcoin builds incentives into its infrastructure. Nodes are automatically compensated for their work, sunk cost in a way, they perform maintaining the network through the issuance of new coins. The system thus attains techonomic closure. The system builds its value from those who are implicitly abiding by the value within the system and therefore feeding back into the system. Technological economic closure in the sense that value begets value in the sense of a closed understanding which isn't reliant on anything external to it. And anyone who's within it has to abide in a sort of a machinic allegiance to Bitcoin. The system thus attains techonomic closure. The horizontal finitude of the Bitcoin money supply necessitates an eventual transition to payments based on transaction fees. This is the eventual close of Bitcoin. Is that the why? You know, why would you continue to develop and help out the Bitcoin network if you're not potentially gaining from it by the way of mining blocks? Transaction fees will then answer that quandary in the sense that there is an expenditure, and anyone helping to allow, you know, anyone housing a node to continue the network gets that, you know, bit of transaction fee, and the value just in the value is like a self-contained feedback loop, or as Land states, a techonomic closure. So well-organized incentives also fulfill a security function by motivating potential attackers to support rather than subvert the network. And I mean, that's a sort of a libertarian principle as well, of that eye of incentive-based sort of incentive-based profit and incentive-based income or incentive-based systems, is that incentives are what drives sort of capitalism to move, an incentive of continued production. 3.27, blocks can be compressed to economize on memory demand by pruning Merkle trees. Moore's law is invoked as a realistic projection of exponential decline in digital memory price over time, moderating the requirement for information parsimony. So parsimony, for anyone who doesn't know, because it's not a word that's used all the time, basically an extreme unwillingness to spend money or use resources, right? You don't want a system, basically what has happened with credit, you don't want a system which increasingly needs more energy to fulfill the system, because what you then have is an exponential growth which may potentially not be able to be fulfilled. What you more than likely are going to have is a growth line which then finds some form of equilibrium, which is in relation to Moore's law, which is the observation that basically the number of transistors in a dense integrated circuit doubles about every 2 years. So you have this increase in interest, but an increase in the ability to moderate that interest via the technology and via the innovative principles, sort of forming perhaps more, we wouldn't call it as an equilibrium, but something that will avoid an exponential growth, you know, as opposed to the exponential growth we see in credit-based systems. 3.28, I'll take questions at the end of 3, which is not far off. 3.28, further economy is offered by a payment verification shortcut involving a modest sacrifice of security in exchange for convenience. So further economy is offered by a payment verification shortcut. There's not much to really say there, but I've considered it as a slightly important addition. 3.29, Bitcoin transactions contain multiple inputs and outputs to facilitate the integration and disintegration of coins during transfers. I mean, if you really wanted to read into that in that Deleuzian sense, then you're looking at the complete immanentization of desire and machines. Once again, everybody who anyone who's read the beginning chapter on desiring machines in Anti-Oedipus will have a realization that that, you know, the inputs and outputs is an imminent productive principle, right? There isn't, production is above anything else. You know, you input food, you output waste. There is a constant, almost cybernetic cycle of input and output information, which is going on, and input and output production, which is going on. And Bitcoin is doing exactly the same thing, except that there is no digressions of value. The value might fragment off the value itself, but it retains the actual ontological objectivity of the value as it is. So 3.291, Bitcoin radically adjusts the structure of transaction privacy. Rather than drawing a curtain of obscurity between a transaction and the world in the traditional fashion, it nakedly exposes the transaction to public scrutiny, which has to happen in the relation to that the imminent horizontal peer-to-peer decentralized network. Everyone has to see what is going on, which then, you know, removes some strange stuff from transactions, because people don't always like to see what is being bought. But I mean, it's very easy for you to not, most people are never going to know who's done what unless you can somehow figure out. I mean, a lot of people have done this, they've found out where a big whale has sold a load of Bitcoin and known who's done it, and then they've kept an eye on that wallet, you know, just, and then they sort of know who it is. But of course, they could move that to another one and move it around, and the privacy would be regained. Does anyone have a link to the document I'm reading? If you search Nick Land cryptocurrency, I might have put it in the description, but if you search Nick Land cryptocurrency, I might be able to. Yeah, I can quickly link it in chat off my phone, actually. 1 second. Nick Land cryptocurrency. It's on like a little GitHub link. I'll now put it in the chat for you guys. Yeah, there you go. So that's the link to that. So where were we? Du-du-du-du-du. The new line of concealment is drawn between the transactional agents and their offline identities. So there's this strange split between, you know, transactional agents. I mean, I love Nick's language here. The idea of a transactional agent as a, you know, that's a complete immanentization of the human being into that, you know, what did I call it in the second lecture? Cosmos economus, right? The complete, everything is completely monetarized into a quantifiable asset in relation to ontologically provable value, in the sense that like everything could be economized, and in that sense in calling man transactional agents, he's doing that like a dark reversion of Foucauldian language, in the sense that we are then demoted below the actual system itself. We're just agents of the system. The system is above, which we of course like to think of ourselves as like above economy, or we made the economy, as if that ever happened. The economy is this just strange Lovecraftian being which is doing what it wants to do, and this is its cybernetic finality. So their offline identities at the precise boundary of the commercium, therefore, and no longer within it. Secure masks are proposed as the new basis of privacy protection, coinciding with the anonymity of public keys. It's like the 90s fanboy dream of the cybernetic future, in the sense that you have transactional agents with secure masks, and identity is assimilated onto a level of production where you just become an agent of that greater ontological machine, if you like. So 3.292, the prospect of a successful attack upon the blockchain diminishes exponentially with the addition of honest blocks. An attacker therefore has a window of opportunity which closes at a rate based on the block processing capacity of the network. It's my understanding that a 51% attack is that if, you know, the only way that Bitcoin can really be taken down is if there's 51% of the, someone has to, like almost in a centralized way, someone has to take over 51% of the power, in that sense that they can then, you know, they're controlling more of the decentralized network, and they could then do what they want with it, what it wants. But as we're on about, as what Land is on about here, with the addition of honest blocks, you then have a just a constantly compounding reason to not do that. And in the sense of that techonomic closure, there seems to be no real reason out of sort of a strange human spite to do so. Because in doing so, you do something quite strange. You almost parasitically infect it with something which it's not, it doesn't care about and wouldn't really know what to do. And the value of, you know, people, someone asked a really great question last time, which is like, is the value of Bitcoin then, even though you have this ontological structure, still reliant on the idea that we all agree with on its value? The techonomic underlying transcendental machinery, which allows Bitcoin to be what Bitcoin is in terms of that objective value, will always be that form of value. However, you know, the agreed upon like thing is the reason. It's funny because people say, what if we all just didn't agree that Bitcoin was worth loads? And no one really investigates the irony of that question is worth loads in terms of what? Because when we go, Bitcoin's worth loads of what? Dollars. But what happens when that flips, which it's starting to do, in my opinion? And what about when people, you know, that'd be $20. What's that? And how many Satoshis is that? Or how much actual value is that? And so there's something interesting in that people say, well, what if we just all don't agree that it's got the value? Well, the point is that it's developed a techonomic closure where BTC equals BTC. So the value is always going to be there because the system is developed in such a way to purport transcendental value, whereas US dollars aren't. So you say, what's it worth? Well, it's not really worth anything in terms of dollars, because as we've realized, we're talking about two different forms of communication. One which is completely transcendental and flat and immanent, and one which is completely reliant on a pseudo-transcendent form of trust-based governance. And those two aren't compatible. And when you try to compatibilize them, you realize that you're entering into sort of an absurdity, right? You're saying, what is this actual value worth in your trust-based system? Well, how does that make any sense, right? One side has to have trust and therefore isn't based on work, and so isn't going to be compatible with the other side. And the other side is based on proof of work and an algorithmically successively verifiable objective positive sunk cost, which I've gone on about. And they're not going to want to integrate into that other side. So these two systems of value are at most have a struggle in the sense of signification. And I mean, there's something to be said of how they're all being valued is very interesting. They're being valued primarily from that other system of valuation, right? Which isn't a system of ontological production in itself. So, 3.32. The threshold crossed here is both subtle and immense. Retrospectively, it will have been almost nothing, since the Techonomic circuitry it invokes was, now demonstrably, already the operational principle of modern civilization, capitalism. It is only through Bitcoin, however, that the essential techno-commercial integrity of capitalism is brought into crisp focus and extracted from speculative debate. I mean, that's a big thing for Land to say. One second. The real question isn't what is the value of Bitcoin in US dollars, but what is the value of US dollars in Bitcoins? Yes, exactly. And if you think on that question for a while, you realize why these two systems of value are very different, because, as I said, trust versus work. But there's a big thing that Land has sort of stated here. The operational principle of capitalism is brought into crisp focus via Bitcoin, right? When the machine is theoretically apprehended holistically as a real individual, or far more consequentially implemented as such, neither its technical nor its economic aspects can be diverted into transcendence or contingency as extraneous, mutually independent factors. Incentives are inherent to the machinery, in a sense more complex and involving than anything the harsh paradox of the term immediately communicates. Bitcoin is a purposive mechanism. The conclusive action of the Bitcoin system, block validation, which seals each cycle of its reproduction, is a non-decomposable teleomechanical step, a diagonal escalation or transcendental synthesis. It is industrialism, the mechanizing market distilled to a previously unrealizable quintessence. I'm annoyed at myself for buggering up the end of that paragraph, because it's like the burn core of it's the absolute burn core of cryptocurrency. It's just it's annoying that it's not 3.33 Land. You really should have sorted that out and got this amazingly erudite and fantastic paragraph, which is sort of reminiscent in my heart, which I wish was colder right now because it's about 28 degrees, of your Land's critique of transcendental miserabilism. And there's, you know, how can you not read this section 3.32 and just not want to, you know, sort of fall to your knees and beg capitalism almost for a sort of a machinic forgiveness? But I mean, what we're talking about here is, not to draw in my own work, but something I wrote about in Accelerationism, Capitalism as Critique, which is that idea of basically, in the sense of a Kantian synthetic a priori, that idea of like you can work something out without having to investigate the empirical reality, from that in converted into the Deleuzian form of production in production, or production of itself, or production at the very end for Land, production for the sake of production, is in coherence with that synthetic a priori, algorithmically provable continuation of production. So it's like a continual, like, is production happening? Yes. And this is all connected to zero in the sense that you can like metrizably prove that off the fact there is profit and loss dynamics, or if there is profit and loss. And from this, Bitcoin, in the sense that it adheres to this objective form of value, like of value, and at the same time has to have this sort of validation, the network is this like beautiful techonomic feedback loop of its own productive vindication of production, which just wants to keep itself going. And it's like a machinic numenic machinic survivability bias which just trumps all others, which you can just underline as capitalism. It's very exciting. So that's what's going on. And I mean, you know, it would almost be interesting to say Bitcoin is just the essence of capitalism, right? It's just the essence of a numenic or a numenal machinic desire for the continuation of its own machinic desire for production. I mean, Land had this brilliant tweet years ago about, you know, the end game of sort of capitalism. It's just this positively nihilistic production of economic production just for the sake of it, right? It's like value production for the sake of it, burning up the universe for the sake of its own production. Once God's dead, that's all that matters. How beautiful. How brilliant. Man. Anyway, 3.45. By dividing Bitcoin output compression between two interlocking processes, the protocol is able to stabilize the rate of block validation in terms of an objective external time metric. The difference between these two modes of nominal or reward restriction reflects a schism in time between the intrinsic, intensive, absolute succession of the blockchain and the extrinsic, geometrized order of pre-existing globalized chronological convention. Integrated reward is a complex chronosynthesis occurring at the boundary where Bitcoin's artificial time, preceding only by successive envelopment of blocks into the chain, meets the social chronometric time of measurable periods. 10 minutes means nothing on the blockchain in itself until connected by an interlock that docks it to a chronometer. So three, if you want to go, what the hell does Land mean by Bitcoin solves the problem of Kantian space-time, then your paragraph to investigate with a keen eye is 3.45. Because what we're talking about here in this division, let's just go through this. These two modes of nominal reward restriction, a schism in time, right? This intrinsic, intensive, absolute succession of the blockchain, which we've gone on about, which is provably objective, ontologically form of value by this decentralized machinic agreement on what has happened in that sense. And you can't cohere that instantly to linear time, because once again, that's a representation. However, the schism in time then is the other side, the time that we experience, the geometricized order of pre-existing chronological convention, right? Our habitually representational time, which goes forward in a line in that form of succession. These two cohere in that form of what I was going on about earlier, that sort of middle ground symbolism where they're able to communicate with one another. And that is what synthetic a priori sort of communication is happening between those two. There is an ability to cohere the absolute intensive succession of production in itself of the outside with the geometrized order of pre-existing chronological time of the inside. And in that, you solve the problem of Kantian blockchain, Kantian space-time. I'm finally glad, you know, it's been done, right? So 10 minutes to us is this, 10 minutes to us is 10 minutes, right? It's a metrizable metric of duration and rhythm and what we consider that to be, but that's not really what time is. 10 minutes only really makes sense. Very important word there. It makes sense in terms of spatiotemporality. So for instance, if I drop this pen from a certain height and it took a certain amount of time to get to the bottom, then you could like record that in terms of 10 minutes, but it would only be verifiable within that closed off dynamic of what representational space-time is, because you have space and time and therefore a certain amount of time in relation to space. However, 10 minutes when it reaches the blockchain, you're able then to, in what has happened in the time of the blockchain, in that algorithmically processed form of successive blocks, you are able to then cohere what the hell 10 minutes is in relation to actual production in itself. And I would go as far to say, you know, you're at that point, you are having a communicative relationship between between phenomena and noumena, in a very strange way. So 3.49. The time of the blockchain is intrinsic and absolute, but its history is a frontier.
where it engages us as the blockchain is installed and thus dated an artificial time in itself, consisting only of absolute succession, is packaged as phenomenon. What I was going on about there, it's packaged, it's compressed, much like a symbol. Packaged, you know, there is a complex amount of data which has come through from this other communicational sort of void, and it's packaged, it's compressed into this sort of symbolization of what is going on in the whole system. 3.7, singularity is a stressed sign even in advance of its capture by theories of decentralized cryptocurrency. It carries a complex of meanings that can easily appear inconsistent, perhaps only arbitrarily concatenated, although this is not a conclusion drawn in the present work. The simplest logico-grammatical sense and usage of the term is fixed by contrast plurality. Singularity is the state of being singular, undoubled, or in any way further pluralized, much like we were talking about earlier with that impossibility of fraudulence. This austere meaning, someone said, I guess capitalism really can go on forever. Capitalism is forever. This austere meaning has been overwhelmed by more exotic cosmophysical, eschatological, and philosophical references to the event horizon of gravitational collapse, to the wall across the future drawn by emergent superintelligences, and to a non-generic being beyond the metaphysics of unity. What the hell is going on in 3.7? Singularity, that amazing, lovely intelligence explosion which is going to happen off the back of a ontologically verifiable system which equates production with intelligence and therefore understands what intelligence is in relation to its own system. Thereby, intelligence begins to just produce intelligence, because intelligence understands that further intelligence produces further intelligence. And what is Bitcoin doing? It is doing that as a self-vindicative intelligence thresher. It is understanding what produces its own circuitry. And in this sense, can we say it is the singularity in itself? I don't think so. In this sense, we can say it is part of the functional apparatus of the bootloader of what we can understand to be the singularity. It is an ontologically pure and singular dynamic function which targets itself towards production in itself and towards its own vindication. It has this sort of machinic, it's like the Judge Holden of the machinic world, right? What's the great Judge Holden quote from Blood Meridian? Whatever exists on Earth without my knowledge exists without my consent. And I mean, that is literally Bitcoin, because nothing can exist without its, you know, I mean, that quote doesn't really work, but it works enough for me, you know. And that's the inhuman mercilessness of Bitcoin in relation to the vindication of its own systemization. So, 3.73. The Bitcoin singularity simulation is, among other things, a philosophical event of extraordinary significance, the technical initiation of absolute succession. From this point, history explicitly enters the phase of synthetic ontology, right, the production of that ontological objectivity, or the techno-commercial production of being, lower B. Reality is regrounded in a catalyzed and henceforth catalytic construction which functions as an ultimate criterion. That singularity, that consistent feedback building. 3.93. Once the cryptocurrency coin suffix, rather than alluding to concrete specie, acquires the status of a defining model, the word coin becomes the technically precise bearer of a semiotic function. A coin, then, would be fully characterized as a unit of DSP-resolved currency, typically instantiated as a highly virtualized internet communicable ledger entry reproduced on a blockchain, which is, it's basically going back to the, like, if you put it in human terms, that Foucauldian notion of everything becomes a coin, everything becomes this verifiably in communication with that other ontologically verifiable thing called Bitcoin, which is now almost like a machinic god. Everything becomes verifiable in that sense, and the coin becomes develops a productive relationship with value. 3.94, besides the signifier and the index, or no less beneath them, is the coin. The signifier, the index, and the coin. The coin is the elusive third. So, moving on to chapter 4, this bit isn't going to be as long, but it will be. We're already on for an hour, but this shouldn't be as long. But does anyone have any questions on what I was going on about there before we sort of head into this sort of game theory type section? No, cool. Chapter 4, State of Play. So 4.01, the ineradicable ambivalence of the social animal is captured by the theory of games. A tiger does not play games with a prey animal any more than bees play games with each other. A game is a transactional integration, at once too intimate for a non-social animal and too fractured for a consolidated collective. So really, Land begins this chapter by begins sort of in relation to this idea of politics that we talk about right at the beginning of writing of cooperation, community, games, and the ability for differing groups to get on a consistent historical problem. Do I care to relate this to Delighted to Death? It's been a long time since I've read Delighted to Death. But if you give me like a few nudges, maybe my brain would be able to recall the main parts of that essay. I can't remember it exactly, unfortunately. So we're talking about game theory here, we're talking about cooperation, and this is really the section where the idea of a political discussion of Bitcoin comes in. So 4.08, Bitcoin is a game in the strong or technical sense because it does not control cheating through a transcendent rule upheld by a trusted third party, but rather through an immanent principle, the Nakamoto consensus. Its immediate ancestry with the game theoretic lineage descends from the formulation of the Byzantine general's problem, dating back to the mid-1970s. Okay, so the problem, as explained, we imagine that there is several divisions of the Byzantine army and they are camped outside an enemy city, each division commanded by its own general. The generals can communicate with each other only by messenger. After observing the enemy, they must decide upon a plan of action between them all, between all these multiple camps, and they must... However, some of the generals, it's generally understood, may be traitors. So they've got to try, and these traitors are trying to prevent the loyal generals from reaching an agreement. So there's complete confusion in terms of this attack, this agreed upon thing that they're all going to do. So the generals have an algorithm to agree that A, all loyal generals decide upon the same plan of action, of course, because everyone who's loyal to the same cause has to agree on the same plan of action, and then you can have this succession. The loyal generals will all do what the algorithm says they should, but the traitors may do anything they wish. The algorithm must guarantee condition A, regardless of what the traitors do. The loyal generals should not only reach agreement, but should agree upon a reasonable plan. We therefore also want to ensure that a small number of traitors cannot cause the loyal generals to adopt a bad plan. So how is this sort of, what's going on with this in terms of Bitcoin? So in 4.091, the Nakamoto consensus in game theoretic context is the name for a solution to this very problem. How can you find a loyalty between all these generals, which is then agreed upon and hasn't been tampered by traitors? By including proof of work within each message, hashed block, the generals are able to make a measure of agreement reached, i.e. computational power committed, into an intrinsic property of their communications. Agreement about the message is folded into the message as blocks are chained, securely in strict succession. The signal of consensus strengthens. In meeting a reiterated proof-of-work criterion, the blockchain accumulates imminent credibility. It replaces an extrinsic and intractable question about the reliability of communications with an intrinsic communication of reliability. Trust is made into the message. The message itself has folded into it the very commitment to the message. The algorithmically provable, you know, objective calculations which are going on by those people putting power into the Bitcoin process, that very energy and power that they're putting into the process is folded into the message itself. Therefore, it wouldn't be a treacherous one because there is this form of committed computational power. Okay, so proof of work is a form of cryptographic sort of zero knowledge proof in which one party proves to others that a certain amount of computational effort has been expended. So the effort put into the message has been folded into the message, which can then be read by the loyal generals. Verifiers can subsequently confirm this expenditure with minimal effort on their part. People can just see that this energy has been expended. So there's no one can sort of come in and just not expend energy. So that in itself is this sort of self-propagating part of or underlying foundation of the Bitcoin system, is this self-propagation via this way of solving the Byzantines general's problem. Someone asked, what would an attack on a cryptocurrency look like?
It's a difficult question. I mean, because you said cryptocurrency and not Bitcoin. On a cryptocurrency generally, many are weak and have different systems. That there's probably almost millions of systems at this point, tens of thousands of systems at this point. So I couldn't ask on cryptocurrency. As for Bitcoin, it's just that 51% attack. Yeah, so just the 51%. And I mean, you know, you say, well, what would it look like? It's difficult to put it into its own terms because the system would still be there. Whether I'm not technically knowledgeable enough to know whether or not if someone succeeded in such attack, they could, like, you know, rip Bitcoin apart from the inside. I don't know whether or not that's possible. Whether or not they could somehow play around with the Linux, a line of succession, thus destabilizing the entire value structure, I don't know. So... In this terms of, you know, what Land has been using before, diagonality overcomes the empirical unhuman by utilizing the inhuman outside in its synthesization of the inside and the outside, right? We can just verifiably see that in terms of the, everyone who's trusted on these nodes and in terms of this decentralized system, everyone who's trusted has this machinic sunk cost of production, which has been put in. So through 4.36, if every discussion of money is vulnerable to corruption by politics, politics itself is pure corruption, at least from the classical liberal perspective that is reanimated in crypto-libertarianism, even if there are far more complementary ways of expressing this point. Politics is the place where language goes to die, sacrificed by necessity to ulterior motivation. Once again, as soon as you're talking about politics, you're talking about third-party trust. The evidence of linguistic history could not be more unambiguous in this regard. Whatever is seized with partisan enthusiasm becomes almost immediately philosophically unstable because you are then immediately moving towards a subjective valuation. It is proposed here, therefore, that thinking the political spectrum through Bitcoin is an approach with inherently superior prospects to the extant and almost certainly doomed alternative of attempting to conceptualize Bitcoin politics through a system of ideological articulations which has already been broken. Bitcoin saves money from politics. Right, you have a transcendental value system which we can adhere by in terms of an almost ontological libertarian principle of what it is people want. Value goes to where people want it. As soon as this is drawn into political debate and the subjective debate of a single partisan enthusiasm, as Land puts it, then immediately you enter into a very strange semiotic digression of what it is the value is actually being led towards, and it isn't. The value is no longer being led towards itself in terms of its own propagation, in the sense that if everybody's put into the system what they want to put into the system, then it should just gravitate towards what is organically leading towards, whereas once it's led astray, then it's being led astray, and this is what politics does. So Bitcoin saves money from politics. You can't have it the other way around. Bitcoin's first. It's an ontological layer. Ontological is first. So 4.37, Bitcoin... Okay, that's my last slide. I'm very sorry about that. It's okay. I don't have too much more here, but that's very strange. Anyway, though, there's a few more bits here to add about politics, and I'll try keep them sort of... 4.37. I'll try to keep it a bit more short now, because I did think I had the paragraphs there. Apparently I don't, so I'm very sorry about that, but you can find them. 4.37, Bitcoin politics has been flavored by a number of supportive ideological themes, among which decentralization and deflation are by far the most emphatic. Both of these themes cater initially to the arc liberal right, represented by classical liberalism, libertarianism, and anarcho-capitalism, and affiliated to the right-wing anti-politics of economic autonomization, deregulation, disintermediation, distributed production of security, and, at the limit, algorithmic governance or local political extinction. The decentered commercium intrinsically secured against political intervention is the incarnated ideal of arc liberal order, and Bitcoin has been seized upon in very substantial part due to its conspicuous affinity with this social model. Okay, big stuff going on in here. We are talking about a spontaneity of economic autonomization which arises from a system which has this form of cryptographic proof of work governance which goes into it. And this, of course, as Land is making clear, is represented in a sort of a human level, though they're very inhuman often, by anarcho-capitalism and, of course, these and libertarians. And these generally, these not so much gravitate, but they are built upon the principles which themselves were trying to remove that third party in empirical means. So economic autonomization, you know, that removal of centralized institutions to control what's going on with money and therefore removing the possibility for fraudulence, deregulation because regulatory bodies are injecting their partisan bias into things, disintermediation, you no longer have a mediation, it is literally a representation, a relationship between the pure objective value and the agent of transaction, and you have distributed production of security. So basically, Land is sort of stating near the end here that Bitcoin does, of course, gravitate towards anarcho-capitalism and libertarian ideals, but not from their level. It's like an ontological basis for them. So, 4.372, money is thus strengthened in its function of unilateral social command as a super political criterion or economic reality signal cleansed of all interference. It becomes essentially policy insensitive against the predominant grain of 20th century political economy. Any cryptocurrency with intrinsic deflationary bias is a right-wing revolt against macroeconomics. It takes itself out of political and administrative service, which is to say, in a philosophical register, that it secures its transcendental function relative to the social process. What the hell does that mean? Production of intelligence and the production of a function to recognize intelligence, basically. What I was going on about earlier, that Bitcoin is very, very sort of slowly, it seems, developing some certain function which can recognize what intelligence is and therefore be able to produce further intelligence in relation to what is in that Mycean way what is genuinely needed in terms of value. So what's really going on here is in avoiding to quote from 4.42, to bring any phenomenon into socio-political question as a phenomenon presumes its prior decryption. There is no politicization of that which cannot first be hacked and then publicly assimilated as symmetrical or dialectical controversy, right? So in avoiding the dialectical humanism of what we consider to be debate in favor of a machinically installed, algorithmically provable intelligence thresher function, the avoidance of discussion enters into the avoidance of politics altogether. All politics is a democratic mess. Politics loves debate, argument, dialectics, discussion. This notion of an equilibrium, but this always gets drawn into a partisan bias. Therefore, it's the complete avoidance of this form of dialectical humanism in favor, or not in favor, the singular machinic function towards its own vindication and its own vindication of intelligence and its own self-propagation itself overcomes that in the sense of like an ontologically libertarian principle of Mycean value. That's one hell of a mouthful. So jumping just to 4.7, just to sort of wrap this up and then take questions. The potentialities of large multi-agent games are not predictable in advance by anything less complex than themselves. They are not compressible except by increasingly unreliable approximation. In consequence, their systematic behavior is surprising or informative. In Kantian terms, it is said to be synthetic. Like all complex adaptive systems, such games are synthesizers, whose coordination searches produce discoveries. They are modeled by simulations which themselves demonstrate synthesis. The conclusions reached by simulating the behavior of complex systems were not analytically accessible in advance. They were not even accessible before in the narrowest empirical historical sense. Were there an essential trans-historical faculty of reasoning, it was unable to reach them. Computers were required to do that. The game, if it is serious enough, let me repeat this because this is an important little end paragraph here. The game, if it is serious enough, has to produce in detail its own conditions of cognitive apprehension within itself. The most elementary perception is already a move downstream from strategy. Nothing is given. Everything has to be won. And that is a Meissian Austrian principle. You know, you can think of winning in that in if you think of winning in the human term, then yes, you have a sunk cost and a commitment to work and to passion, to endeavor. But if you think about it in the machinic term, you have a commitment to the success or the winning of a computational CPU power, sunk cost and a commitment to that. And in that, the game, as it's understood in Bitcoin dynamics, is something which just has to, it has its own conditions within it and therefore abides by its own form of value. So, I sort of quickly hastened the little end section there because I didn't have the slides for it. Don't know why, don't like technology anymore. But I'm happy to take questions now at the end. Just whatever you guys would like to ask. And then it'll be over. And then the next one, chapter 5 and 6, it'll probably be about 2 weeks away because it's just, I want to try and find a way to get some new perspectives in there as well. Okay. Well, I'll consider that. Oh, someone did have one there. Yeah. Someone compared ETH to communism on Twitter once. How does proof of stake compare to proof of work? I'm not too savvy on that, so sorry for the one question that was asked. I don't know too well. I mean, as I understand it, proof of stake still has a commitment to the system because a lot of the time staking is locked. So there is still there's got to be this commitment to it. In the sense that Ethereum is communism, I mean, that's an interesting idea because, you know, there's an idea that Bitcoin is value, Ethereum is contracts, and Urbit is like land, right? So, I mean, in that sense, communism was very tied up with regulation and control. So, you know, certainly sounds about right. But I think I'm going to leave it there. Thanks, everyone, for coming along. The next one, as I said, will be in a couple of weeks. Sorry for any technical hitches and the delay at the start, as per usual. But, you know, still getting used to these live streams. So thanks for coming along. Like, subscribe, share it, donate if you fancy it.